Aye. Reminder, and the places are all confirmed now, and the one for tomorrow is not the one that was on the board yet, Monday. So, after class today, living learning. We'll just migrate over there. Tomorrow at 5 in Campus Center Theater, that's the one attached to Billings, behind the chapel. Sunday, here, at 5. And those are all set. There'll be about an hour and a half. Bring your questions. Bring your notes. The sessions today and Sunday will be recorded, and I will put them on the web. So if you can't make it, you can listen to them if you would like. Okay. Yes. Everything. Everything. Yep. So that means we have to get from puberty to recycling today. Here we go. Chug, 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 chug. Other questions? If you have not checked out the website, you might want to do that. There are some sample essay questions, like the ones that will be on the exam. There is a new page of study tips. So you might want to check that out. Many people have asked me for guidance on how you prepare for the exam. And everything that Talia and I could think of is on that page called Study Tips, which you access from the news page on the course website. Form? 75 or 80 multiple choice questions and a Scantron sheet that goes along with that, so bring a number 2 pencil. And short essays. We will give you the paper. You have about half a page to write on, so practice writing relatively small. Also write relatively slowly. And most of all, write intelligently. What do we have? 18 essay questions? She's nodding, yes, but... No. Do you like choices? Yeah, okay. We will give you 4 questions and ask you to write 3 of them. Okay. So you get to not choose the one, or choose not to write on the one that you don't understand most. Right. Yes. A half a page, yep. Legal size, half a legal sheet for each. Okay. Yes, you are allowed to stay. There is no time limit. The only time limit is that at some point Talia might want to go to dinner. She usually eats by 9. But no, it won't take you that long. But some of you do take longer than others, and there's no penalty for that. We cannot stay in this room, so we will move. And we have an alternate room. Those of you who are still here at that point will simply pick up all of our stuff and move to the other room. And the same for those of you who are in Bodhi. I'm trying to remember more details than I have in my head. I don't know whether you have to move or not. I think maybe you don't. but Talia will know.
Okay, if you have the class that's in here after the exam and you're not finished.
Hard choices. If you have a class after the exam, I can't advise you. No, because there's a class in here before. So if you have a class immediately after, or a meeting, or your parking meter runs out, or you're scheduled for an appendectomy at 5 o'clock, you know, that's your limit, and we can't avoid those. So in your case, you have the choice of, if you're not finished, you can come with us to the other room, finish, and then come to class late. Or you can make a choice. Or you'll just be done. It's okay. Other questions? I guess it got answered. Okay. Good. Okay, and remember, don't lose sleep all weekend worrying about it. Get a good night's sleep. Eat well. Stay healthy. Don't go out and get exhausted the night before. Or between now and then. Live a clean life. You know how to do that. I hope. We'll talk about that, actually. We're going to talk about living a clean life because it's important not only for doing well on the exam, it's important for staying out of nursing homes when you get older and living a long and healthy, happy life. And if that doesn't convince you, people who live clean and orderly lives have more and better sex longer as they age than others. So make fun of my lifestyle if you want. But, okay. All right. Speaking of, yes, all right. I get the last laugh. All right. So this is where we were, and I wanted to find out if there were questions about that. I want to review a couple of things about the chart and then see if you have questions about what it means. But the review is, these are organs in the brain. Puberty begins when the hypothalamus detects that the body has reached the trigger weight, and it secretes increased amounts of signaling hormones that kick the pituitary and cause it to increase its output of all of these wonderful hormones. They affect specific endocrine organs. The thyroid, the adrenal cortex is a major player in this, and the gonads. As those endocrine organs get stimulated, they mature or increase their output of the hormones that they're responsible for, thyroid hormone, stress hormones, androgens and estrogens from the adrenal cortex. And we all, male and female, experience those changes. And the increase in androgens and estrogen from the adrenal cortex causes these changes in both male and female. The degree of those changes in part depends on the amount secreted, and that is variable. It depends on the responsiveness of the end targets, and that varies. Some of us, for example, have hair follicles that are very responsive to small amounts of androgen. And it doesn't take much androgen to kick off hair growth for those of us. For others, it takes a higher level in order to stimulate the hair follicles to mature and start producing hair that will survive. The same for breast buds. Some people respond to very small amounts of estrogen. Others, it requires much larger amounts of estrogen. That's genetic and it's variable. So there are a number of sources of variability in how quickly you respond, how quickly puberty happens, and how it progresses. These estrogens and androgens are not necessarily secreted at the same time. That's also variable. So some people show the androgenic effects before they show the estrogenic effects. And the book talks about these as the result, the process of andrenarche, is showing the androgenic effects, and these as estrogen or estriarche in the text. And what they're referring to is showing the effects of these two classes of hormones differentially. Some of us have a good deal of synchrony. We develop in all areas about the same time and about the same rate. What effects you show also will depend on the relative balance of these two, since androgens and estrogens tend to antagonize each other. So you can secrete a large amount of androgen, but you won't show the androgenic effects if you secrete an even larger and more powerful amount of estrogen. So there are many ways in which the hormones vary, from the production of them to the sensitivity of the targets to the balance between them, that cause all that incredible variability that we show as we go through puberty. On the right side of this chart, the males and the females differ. On the left side, thyroid and adrenal cortices, we all have that, we all have the hormones, we all have the target organs. But only the males have testes, only the females have ovaries, so anything that is secreted by the testes affects only males. Anything that is secreted by the ovaries is present only in females. Okay. The reason that males get bigger, more muscular, our body composition is different, we're hairier, our voices are deeper, our skin is darker, rougher, and all of that is because in addition to the androgens from the adrenal cortex, we add the testosterone from the testes, which have the same targets. The reason females develop more subcutaneous fat, bigger breasts, is because to the estrogen from the adrenal cortices, they add the estrogen from the ovaries. So the different effects for male and female, the differentiation of male and female, is because we have different gonads. And we've had those different gonads from the sixth week of embryonic life. It just hasn't made any difference until puberty, when those organs become really important and affect our development. Okay? Questions about that? Pardon? Yes. A small amount of testosterone, and the problem with the chart and with the nomenclature, even the 9th edition and the 10th edition of the text differ, and differ from this, because this is a class. It's a group of hormones that includes androstenedione. Testosterone is a metabolic intermediary between androstenedione and the real problem. I'm way outside my depth endocrinologically, but if you look at the chemistry of these. Those of you who are in organic chem have this, right? You all know this. That these, in fact, are very closely related hormones, and as they're metabolized and break down, you will get, for a brief period of time, you will get estrogen as you break down testosterone. As you break down testosterone, you will have a form of estrogen. And the metabolic problems sometimes, some genetic problems, are because people are taking the androgenic substance and only metabolizing it part way and then having estrogen effects because they have a large amount of estrogen as a byproduct circulating. So the chart is very simplistic and the endocrinology of it is very complex. But women will have, in addition to the estrogen, they will have androgens, including testosterone. But sometimes you'll read an article and they say testosterone, but that's not actually the chemical that's being produced. It's actually androstenedione, which you don't need to know, even how to spell it. So, but endocrinology is fun. Because of that, it's also extremely complex. I'm deciding not to. Okay, I just didn't talk about something that I could have, but I'm not going to. Yes?
How does the condom affect hermaphrodite?
I have no idea. The question was, how does this process affect hermaphrodites? Since there are so few hermaphrodites, that we will save that for the biological anomaly seminar next year. But sign up for it, if it's offered. I have no idea, and there probably is very little literature on puberty and hermaphrodites. What does happen that is important is that puberty can get kicked off very early. It can get kicked off very early if you, for example, administer estrogen to three-year-old girls, they will develop breast buds and vaginal discharge. If you administer androgens, particularly testosterone, to three- or four-year-old boys, they will start developing. And that's where I was going with the chart next. I said you could play junior endocrinologist. If you look at somebody whose development is happening, but happening asynchronously, or parts of it are happening, but other parts aren't, you can look up the steps and figure out what's happening or not happening. For example, little girl develops breast buds. Four years old. Okay, this was a kid I saw in Minneapolis when I was a graduate student. Developing breast buds, actually some labial enlargement, though that wasn't very much, but some vaginal discharge, which her mother noticed during a bath, and she also noticed the breast buds. The kid was not overweight. So the mother brings her to the endocrinologist, and the question is, what's going on here? So the psychology intern interviews the little girl. The physician does a blood test and says, sure enough, this kid has estrogen in her system. So the clever intern interviews the little girl to figure out what she's thinking. No hypothesis, just, you know, is something going on intellectually because of this? Or does she have a brain tumor which is causing precocious puberty? Turns out the little girl likes to play mommy. This is a lot of fun. She likes to take her doll. She likes to pretend she's nursing her doll. And part of pretending to be mommy, imitating mommy, is to take a pill just like mommy. Yeah. And it appears that she has done this about three times over the course of 6 days. And they are mommy's birth control pills. Okay. She has gone into mommy's purse, she has taken a pill, and she has taken a pill, just like mommy does, because she wants to be just like mommy. Well, it only takes about three, and they were fairly high dose. This was back in the old days, in the 60s, when birth control pills had much higher doses than they do now because they thought you had to. Breast development. Stop taking the pill. Mommy puts your pill where she can't get it. The breast development disappears. Vaginal discharge stops. She goes back to being a normal kid. So this was happening. This was coming from someplace, but it was an external administration. Pittsburgh. Seven-year-old guy with a low voice, fully developed pubic hair, beard, mature testicles and penis in Children's Hospital. Endocrinologist trying to figure out what's going on. He has all of the changes are taking place. And he has normal adolescent male testosterone level. He also has estrogen from the adrenal cortex. So everything is happening. Everything is involved. He has elevated growth hormone, elevated thyroid hormone. That means that something is happening here. Something is happening in his head. What's happening, unfortunately, is an inoperable tumor, which is pressing on both the hypothalamus and the pituitary. They are responding to the cancerous growth. It was fatal. They are responding by kicking off puberty. And they started that when he was about 4. He didn't come into the hospital until he was about 5 and a half. And it was fascinating to interview him. He was hitting on all the nurses. He was going through all of the changes that one would expect, but he had about a 7-year-old's mind and inhibitions, which made it a little difficult. Unfortunately, he did die. Which steroids? It depends on whether she's taking androgenic. If she wants to be Barry Bonds and she's taking testosterone, she's going to screw up puberty badly. She's going to show the effects, and she's going to counteract her estrogen, so she's going to depress the estrogenic effects. And as we know from Barry, just watch if Barry Bonds really is taking testosterone or other growth hormones, just watch his physiology over the next 10 years. Because one of the reasons that we argue against the use of steroids, particularly in adolescents, so vociferously, is that they can kill you. They screw up your physiology. They screw up your nervous system. They're very potent. They're very potent. And kids taking them often don't have any clue how potent they are. But they are messing up their physiology in many ways. Okay? So you can use this chart to trace problems if your sibling or your niece or nephew is showing some changes. You can get a handle on whether the androgen or estrogen is in larger amounts or they're more sensitive to it. You can do all that sort of stuff. One other thing I want to point out is that the adrenal cortices are also the major source of corticosteroids, the stress hormones. And what happens as you go through puberty is that, remind me to do a graph of this. Talia, please remind me. It was a little vague, wasn't it? What happens is that from infancy on, you secrete corticosteroids from before birth on. And what happens when you're a little kid is that when you get stressed, you get scared, or mom frustrates you, you have a spike in the corticosteroid output from the adrenal cortices. That's what happens when you're under stress. It blips up. When the stress goes away, you metabolize those corticosteroids, and they have a relatively short half-life in the body. So the four-year-old has a temper tantrum. If you measured the corticosteroids during that temper tantrum, you'd find the spike. And then when it subsides, when he gets sent to his room and starts to calm down, then the corticosteroids are metabolized fairly quickly. And this is the timeout period. And you tell him to come out and apologize. And when he feels better, he can join the family. So he comes out in 15 minutes, and he's fine. Go. If you're pubescent, your base level is a little higher. You have a run-in with mom, and the adrenal cortices go nuts. And they secrete, I've exaggerated it. It's only about 8 times higher than that, not 10. And there it is, and you metabolize it until you get back down to base level. You send the kid to her room when she's in the middle of this screaming match, and you tell her to come out. Under the influence of the corticosteroids, she has elevated heart rate, elevated blood pressure, elevated muscle tension, increased lung surfactant, all of those things that are going to make you ready to fight or flee, jazzing up your body. She is really jazzed up. She's really psyched. She's ready to fight. And her body is going to come down 2 hours later, or three. And parents say that when kids go through puberty, they become more emotional. Yes, indeed. Blame it on the adrenal cortices. And the problem is that now she's in her room, still feeling upset. Her body is really upset. And she has the intellectual wherewithal to try to figure out what her problem is. And maybe not enough of the intellectual wherewithal to figure out how to solve the problem. So during this period, she decides to kill herself. Or kill her mother, or take drugs, or have sex with her boyfriend, or any of those other things that you do when you think you're going to resolve your being upset. Okay. So kids do become emotional, and they stay more emotional, upset longer. And then fortunately, we become adults. And during the pubescent years, adolescence, early adolescence, the adrenal cortex is secreting more corticosteroid hormones than it ever will again. Not only that, now we're into old age, as you get older, the adrenal cortex becomes less active. So when you get to my age, people don't piss you off as much anymore. You don't get stressed. You've noticed that in your grandparents, right? It's one of the reasons you like to hang around with your grandparents. They don't get bent out of shape. Yeah, they've seen it all. And one of the reasons that they don't get bent out of shape is that their bodies just aren't responding. They're not getting upset. Yeah. Partly because of what's going on in their head. Well, I've seen this before. Oh, let me tell you what your mother did when she was your age. And they're not getting upset. They're not getting as upset because they have lower levels of corticosteroid because their adrenal cortices are wearing out. Which is why one of my family nicknames, my son, nicknamed me Captain Valium. Because I don't get upset as much as I used to, or as much as he did. Okay, questions about that in process of puberty? boys and girls aren't very different bodily and physiological function until puberty. And then they get more different because of what happened to them under the influence of the SRY gene or not having it during the embryonic period. Kind of a sleeper effect. Yes, you can exhaust your adrenals. I think that was the question. Is that the question? Yes, you can exhaust your adrenals by being under constant chronic stress. The first thing the adrenals do is try to grow bigger, but eventually you exhaust them, and when you're under chronic stress, one of the things that happens is your body essentially stops responding and you get numb. And chronic stress, ongoing stress, will lead to that because the adrenals essentially run out of fuel. Is it fixable? Yes. The adrenals will recover. You don't burn them up. You just exhaust them. You exhaust their resources, and then over time they will recover and you'll get back to being emotional again. Question? That depends on you, your age, and the nature of the stress. One of the reasons that you learn to manage your stress is so that you don't do that. We all, if we're smart, learn to manage stress, go out and metabolize the corticosteroids by increasing our metabolic rate by exercise. Okay. You learn not to drink when you're upset. Why not? Alcohol slows down your metabolism. It's a depressant. So if you drink, you're not metabolizing the stress hormones as quickly as you would if you don't drink. So instead of going out and getting drunk when you're upset, take a walk, go for a run, listen to music, you know, whatever it takes. The question is about the effects of ecstasy on that. I have no idea. I have no idea what the chemistry of ecstasy is or what it does to the adrenal cortices. So I'm gonna bail on that question. And then you go through puberty, and then you're a grown up and you're figuring out how to use your body. Puberty, if it happens very quickly, tends to lead to clumsiness and awkwardness. I promised to talk about my brother. Yeah. There are different patterns, and they are important. For example, my brother's growth pattern was that in the sixth grade, he started to grow. He was 3 years older than me. He was always at the 95th percentile in growth. He was a big boy growing up. And during the latter half of the sixth grade and beginning of the seventh grade, he got to 6 feet. Okay. So he finished the seventh grade 6 feet tall. Okay. He spent part of the seventh grade in bed because he was growing so quickly. He had what is very common, joint pain in his knees and shoulders and elbows because of the stress on them from the increasing weight and bone growth. It took him a long time to gain coordination of that much larger body because it changed so quickly. I would argue he never really got it. But it was fun to go to his eighth grade basketball games. He was the center, of course. He was the tallest kid in the class. He could either play defense or offense, but not both. So the coach had to choose. Do you put him under the one basket or the other? Because he can get the rebounds and pass the ball, but by the time he gets to the other end, the play is going to be over and coming back at him. And if he tries to change direction in the middle of the court very quickly, he's going to have to pick himself up off the floor. because he's going to get his feet wrapped up around each other. One of the joys of my childhood was his basketball games. Another was watching him walk down the stairs, enter the living room, and fall over. And just fall over. We played a lot of tennis, and that was lots of fun because I always won. 3 years younger, little bitty kid, shoot the ball that way, he'd go that way, he'd return it, I'd shoot it that way, point mine. It was fun. He's deceased. Sorry, Ron. Okay. So along came me 3 years later. I had always been at the 5th to the 10th percentile. Same father. Two growth patterns. So along came Larry, and he starts to grow about 7th grade. And he goes into 9th grade, 5 feet 2. And he grows for a long time. He finally reaches 5'10", sophomore year of college. Okay. So which one is abnormal? The second one, because the first one establishes the norm as far as the parents are concerned. Okay. So I come along. I'm obviously, there's something wrong with me. Right? They'll take me to the endocrinologist, not him. But the advantage is that, of course, I'm graceful and well-coordinated because I had all this time to adjust to this changing body. Slow, regular growth is much easier to adapt to than that. And many kids, both male and female, have difficulty with clumsiness during the pubescent years when it's happening very quickly. Where am I now? It's really bad news at the doctor when I had my physical this summer. 5'9¼". Okay. I've lost 3/4 of an inch over the last 30 years as my spine compresses. I don't know, my legs are bowing. I don't know what's happening, but anyway. Okay, so these are both normal patterns in the same family from the same parents. And this pattern, the fast early growth, is the pattern that my father had shown. And my father was 6'1 when he went into high school. That was his final height. There are men in the direct line of the family whose adult height is everywhere from 5'6 to 6'8. So there's huge variability within the family. My two uncles have the growth pattern that I had. And I'm actually taller than both of them were in adulthood by about 1/2 inch or 1 inch. My son had my pattern. If he has children, it's likely that they will have his pattern. I'm guessing. So it's genetic, but there's variability within the family. There are different gene types, different growth patterns within the same gene pool, and which one you get depends on which sperm and which ovum you got. Okay? All right, so we got through adolescence. And then there's adulthood. And you reach your physiological peak sometime around 20, 22. About the time you graduate from college, that's about it. All of your organs are functioning well. You've reached your adult size. You haven't got as much hair on your back as you will later. But everything is working at about the peak, and adulthood is characterized by gradual decline. So aren't you looking forward to becoming an adult? In the text, in the sections on middle adulthood, particularly that chapter, you'll find a number of statements about organ systems or functions that begin to decline at 40 or begin to decline at 50. And that's one set of views, but the other set of views, in fact, the text even provides a chart of decline happening from 30 on for many major functions. So here's the bad news. The basal metabolic rate, not the herb, it's misprint on this one. Your muscular work rate, you don't have to write all these down, just get the bottom line, which is everything goes to hell across adulthood. Cardiac output, your maximum respiratory capacity. This one starts at 30 and everything is going down. From a different text, how about the sensory system? Visual acuity doesn't go down until, and then from 70 to 90, it's unfortunate. Odor identification goes down more slowly. Speech intelligibility, that's a function of the ear, is declining, which is why I have difficulty sometimes hearing your questions if there's a fan on in the background. Here's another one. Nerve conduction speed doesn't go down all that much, but it does go down. Kidney function, cardiovascular function, muscle strength, useful lung volume, maximum breathing capacity. This chart shows all of those at their maximum at about 20. There are variations on that. That's why I don't spend much time talking about adulthood. Why would I want to give you all that depressing news? Let's look at another change. Some of you have mothers who are going through menopause, right? Okay, let's talk about ova. Because what happened was you started ovulating during puberty. The ova were rapidly created. All of them that you have during the third and fourth month of gestation. Now, all you had was the incipient ova, but you had the germ cells, they proliferated, and then they're just going to sit there, except that you're going to have maybe 6 to 7 million of them as you go through gestation, so about 20 weeks, and then they're going to start dying off. You make more than you need. So by birth, you probably have 2 to 3 million. They're oocytes. They're the germ cells. They will become ova after puberty. By the onset of puberty, they're still dying off, but you probably have 400,000. And from puberty until menopause, you probably are going to mature about 450 of them. They're recruited by the hypothalamus with some help from the pituitary. They say, okay, keep going, ova, keep going, ovaries, mature those ova, and then what's going to happen as you get up into your 30s, is that the number recruited each month is going to decrease. So the rate at which you are maturing ova is declining. As your ovaries are maturing ova, you are secreting estrogen. So the more ova you are maturing, the more active your ovaries are, the more estrogen you have circulating. As fewer mature each month, you secrete less estrogen. And less estrogen results in the physiological changes that lead up to menopause. And one of the problems is that as you go into adulthood, go through adulthood, the pituitary and the hypothalamus, which have communicated with each other during puberty and have been responsible in their communication for your menstrual cycle and other bodily functions such as your sleep cycles and your temperature regulation, the pituitary and the hypothalamus begin not to speak easily to each other or clearly, or one responds. It's kind of like an old married couple. You know, they sometimes don't communicate well. And as that communication becomes less consistent, then physiological cycles become less regular. So starting in the mid-30s or so, women begin having more difficulty regulating their temperature. And what happens, they come into this room, which is cold right now, right? And so normally we increase our metabolic rate so that we can generate a little more heat. And most of us do that, most of us in this room do that fairly well. But if I bring your mothers into this room, they will have more difficulty doing that. So they will complain more about the temperature. And they will have, it'll take them longer to adjust for their bodies. I'm sorry?
And they're all crazy. They don't complain a lot.
I'm not going there. I'm not going there. Okay. By the time you stop menstruating, you have no more ova to recruit and to mature. And so you stop producing estrogen from the ovaries. And the estrogen you have left now is from the adrenal cortices. And estrogen affects lots of different things. The text talks about some of them. And here's a graph of that. This, it's not to scale, but it shows what's happening prenatally, during infancy, childhood, and then puberty. The three groups of hormones that are listed here all increase at puberty. This is luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone. And this is estradiol, which is a major estrogen secreted by the ovaries. Way up. And then through adulthood, all three of these are relatively steady. And then as you prepare for menopause, estrogen takes a dive. Luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone increase, and they have some impact on the body. But the estrogen goes down drastically. I was mentioning metabolic rate and temperature regulation. Is one of the reasons that when you go on an automobile trip with your father and your mother, if they still are together and speak to each other, he has learned to dress in layers and not wear a sweater when you get in the car to take a trip. Because she's going to be turning up the temperature. She's going to turn up the heater. I won't talk about my relationships. But anyway, one of the things I learned dating in my 40s and 50s was when you get in a car with a middle-aged woman, be prepared to change what you're wearing fairly quickly because it's likely to be too hot. And the same thing happens at night. So if you have an electric blanket, it needs to have dual controls. Because men aren't going through the same changes. We're not having difficulty adjusting our body temperature. Women are. One of the major complaints of perimenopausal women is that they don't sleep well. And they begin to resent their husbands or partners because we sleep well. You know. No problem. What's happening is that the sleep-wake cycles are being disrupted. And there are a number of reasons for that, but essentially what's happening is that you go through the sleep cycle and, you know, 2 hours of deep sleep, go through the cycle, you're well refreshed, you do that a couple of times a night, and that's enough. And this is my sleep cycle, and this is a menopausal woman's. She woke up. She surfaced like a dolphin. She wakes up. She starts to think. She starts worrying. And she can't go back to sleep. Eventually she goes back to sleep, later does the same thing. Her sleep is disrupted, and she actually gets less sleep, and that's because she's going through this disruption of cycles. And that's one of the reasons, if mother is going crazy, that's one of the reasons it's sleep deprivation. Estrogen, what are you using it for? Okay. If you have enough estrogen, that's good for your bladder and your sphincters. Nutrient absorption and metabolism. So just read, all of these can become a problem if you stop producing estrogen. Blood pressure and cardiovascular function, that's part of the waking up. Memory and cognition, that's a little more iffy. The organization and expression of daily rhythms, and age-related diseases progress more quickly when you remove the estrogen from the system. After menopause, women become much more susceptible to heart disease and cardiovascular accidents, stroke particularly, because the estrogen has protected their cardiovascular system, so they begin to catch up with the men who've already had the problems. Women begin to catch up after menopause. So they'll tell you to take estrogen replacement, and then we discover that that is a problem too. Okay, a couple of things I want to say about the decline. Aging is not a disease. Okay. Although your bodily functions are declining, your organ capacities, they are declining at variable rates. And the decline is not necessarily very steep. It can be steep because of what you do to your poor body. And the major factors that underlie health problems, all of these are elaborated in the text, are alcohol abuse, smoking, lousy diet, and lack of exercise. And every one of those is unrelated to how old you are. Every one of those is something you do to yourself. And you don't have to do any of them. In fact, if you don't do them, you will live longer. You will be healthier. If you look at the causes of death, this is an old chart now, but the causes of death haven't changed much. Heart disease, cancer, stroke, pulmonary disease, the top four are all related to lifestyle. Yes, there's some luck involved. Yes, genetics is involved, but in every one of those, if we stop the alcohol, smoking, bad diet, and lack of exercise, every one of those would improve. And those are the top four. And compare to liver problems, almost minor. And notice that drug abuse, heroin addiction, not on there. Yeah. All those things we have wars on aren't on there. Not that you should do them, but not enough of us do them compared to the number of us who smoke, drink too much, have lousy diets, and don't exercise. If you want to live longer and do well on the exam, the text, this is a summary, it's a slightly different list, but everybody comes up with essentially the same list. Exercise regularly, keep your weight under control, sleep, don't smoke, drink a little or not at all. Be sociable, laugh a lot. And the text gives you some quotes about that. A merry heart doeth as much good as something. Having a small fortune, I think. If you do all of those, and you're 45 years old, your life expectancy, if you're male, goes up by 11 years. If you do all of them, compared to somebody who does only two or three. Less effect for women. So guys, now, important concept. This is an important concept about what happens as you age. Life maintenance reserve is an umbrella term for your ability to deal with stress, do the things you want to do, recover from a cold, and live reasonably well. And so it's a collection of bodily factors, all of which are influenced by those poor health causing factors. Now, if you look at, say, 20, like the other charts did, 100% of, you're really healthy. You can fight off colds. You can recover from broken bones. As you age, all of those things that are declining in your body are going to accumulate so that eventually you're going to reach the point where your body integrity is not going to allow the system to continue. And whether it's your heart that gives out, your kidney, your liver, your lungs, whatever it is, something is going to go below this threshold, whatever it is, and you're going to die. Okay? The blue line, let's say, is just, that's what's going to happen to you. The red line is what's going to happen to you if you have poor nutrition, lack of exercise, lots of stress, all of those things. You're going to reach that point earlier. So you're going to die young. And if you have lots of bad things happen to you, we could draw another line there that's going to kill you by the time you're 45. The green line is the potential curve for people who don't do any of the bad things to themselves and who have good luck and good genes. They are healthier, they stay healthier longer because they're exercising, they're getting sleep, they have friends, they're consulting the doctor, they're treating things that might happen to them earlier. And when they do decline, it's going to be sudden. Okay. Now, this is, if you want to give your grandparents a book or your parents, it may be too late for your grandparents, a book by John Bland, who's a retired professor here, called Live Long, Die Fast. And it's based on this principle, which is, that if you stay healthy and work at it, go to the gym, keep your cardiovascular function up, do yoga, all those other nice things, you will be healthier and happier and sexually more... Anyway, whatever. And then when you do start to decline, you're likely just to drop dead. Yeah. Which is the way you want to go. What are people afraid of when they get older? Being bedridden, going into a nursing home, you know, spending years in a wheelchair or in bed, not knowing what's going on. The way you want to die is the way John's going to. He's a cross-country ski racer. I think he's 87. I've lost track of his age. He's up in his 80s anyway. And he still races. And one of these days, he's going to be racing. He's going to drop dead. He's going to be really happy. A lot happier when he dies doing what he loves to do than somebody who's gradually fading over 3 or 4 years in a nursing home. The reality is that the higher you keep your fitness level, it's really what this is, it's your fitness level, the higher you keep it, the shorter the time it will take you to die. And you will spend less time in a nursing home, you will spend less money on your physical care. Most of you will spend more money in your last 6 months of life on medical care than on all of the years before the last 6 months of life. So if you just, from your conception to your death, just chart how much is being spent on you for medical care, and it's going to spike the last 6 months of your life. Because they're going to be trying to keep you alive when, if you really want to do it your way, you do it like Judge Coles. Judge Coles was a local judge here who helped establish the Long Trail. When he was 88, he was climbing Camel's Hump with his son. And his son noticed that his father had lagged behind a little bit as they got toward the top. He turned around and asked his father if he was okay, and his father smiled. Yeah, I'm fine, go on, I'll catch up with you at the top. He turned around a couple of minutes later, his father was dead on the trail. The only sad part about it, he was 88. He was climbing Camel's Hump at 88. He dropped dead. The sad part was they had to bring him down. They wouldn't let him bury him up there, which is what he would have wanted to do. So, now, how do you... Another use of that, let me... Yeah. Okay. Same concept. Okay, we have different people here. But what I want to point out is that whenever you are stressed, you get a cold, you get the flu, you have an exam, you lose a night's sleep, you break up with your girlfriend, those stressors cause a decrease in your life maintenance reserve. And then when the stress abates or you start to recover, you go back up. The problem for many people is that they accumulate repeated insults to their bodies. So the next stressor before you recover drops you down even farther. If you accumulate those, one of the problems is that it can bring you down here, below the level where you can survive. Which is why your first heart attack, is less likely to kill you than your second heart attack. Why? Because your first one doesn't bring you down far enough. You start to recover. Then you have the second one. It's the second or third one that will kill you, because you haven't rehabilitated. What you want to do is whenever you have a stressful period in your life, you want to recover fully. So when you get the flu, don't come to class. Stay home. Drink orange juice. Take vitamin C. Sleep. Do not come out here and expose the rest of us. Do not come out here and stress your body, because it wants to stay in bed to recover from the flu. Whenever you have something wrong, recover. Recover fully. And then rehabilitate. You've not been to the gym for 3 months because you had a broken leg? Go back to the gym. You can bring yourself to a higher level than you were at, and theoretically, you can, at any point in your life, make yourself healthier than you were before you got sick or before you had the stress. That's what rehabilitation is about. My favorite example of that is the cardiac rehab program here. I don't think they meet in the gym anymore. Maybe do they? Do you still see the old folks over there on the treadmills? No? Okay. They used to have a cardiac rehab program. So you had your heart attack, you survived, they got you out of the hospital, and they sent you over to the gym every day to get on the treadmill, on the stationary bike. They tested you, they kept you from overstressing your body, and they rehabilitated you. Okay. Used to be when you have a heart attack, they would tell you, okay, just take it easy now for the next rest of your life. No more running, no more anything. Take it easy. Your heart is damaged. You know, don't make love. Don't do any of that stuff. And people would gradually sink into depression and death. But now they tell you, okay, you've been stressed. We're going to put you back together. And what happens in the cardiac rehab program, if you stick with it, is that very quickly you reach a higher level of fitness than you were at when you had the heart attack. And if you stay with it, you reach a much higher level. So what happens is they get these old guys in there, 55, 60, you know, even, I'm older than that. Anyway, these old guys, and they rehabilitate them after quadruple bypass surgery. And there are some of them who run marathons. They didn't run a marathon before they had a heart attack. But after they've rehabilitated, they do run marathons. They run races regularly. And they run them until they die in their 90s. Because they have increased, by rehabilitation, they have increased their fitness level. And as the text will tell you, there is no limit to your ability to increase your fitness level. You can start at any time to improve it, and you can improve it until you die. The best studies come from Tufts University, where the physiology folks did weight resistance training and aerobic training with people who were in their 80s and demonstrated that you can increase muscle mass, you can increase lung capacity, you can increase bone density well into your 80s. And as you do that, you're raising the curve and making it more likely that you will die active and happy.
Isn't there a point where
it's
there
another
death?
No. Well, yes, when you're dead.
So, like, if
there are organs that cannot be repaired, but that doesn't keep you from increasing the rest of the capacity of the system. And some organs do repair themselves. Liver, for example, regenerates. The heart will get stronger if you stress it appropriately. Bone will increase in density if you stress it appropriately. And that will continue to happen. So there are things you may not be able to do. If you've lost your legs because of diabetes, you're not going to run. Okay. Diabetes affects circulation in the lower limbs. You've all probably encountered relatives or friends who have that experience. That doesn't keep you from exercising to increase your aerobic capacity, and increasing your aerobic capacity with upper body exercise increases the functionality of all of the rest of your organs.
So if you're like an alcoholic until you're like 45 and you just stop drinking, will your liver fix itself?
Your liver will regenerate if you have not damaged it beyond repair, but if you've damaged it beyond repair, you're in the process of dying. So yes, the liver will repair itself. You need to eat wisely. It helps to do all the other good fitness things along with it, so that the whole system is participating in the regeneration of the liver.
But it has potential for being 100% again?
Well, it's going to be better than it was. And the better it is, the better you are. You're not going back to when you were 20. But you can go way up toward the highest possible given where your body is at that point. So, and that's the... I got 5 more minutes. I'm going to use them. We got to die. Okay. So the lesson from the Tufts studies, which have been replicated all over the world, is that there is never a point until death when you can't improve your health. And the more you improve it, and the earlier you do that, the better your quality of life will be. Because the higher this line is, the fewer pains and aches you have. The higher that line is, the more likely you are to be able to do the things you want to do, like open your Ensure bottle. or move your television or any of the other things. The more strength you have and the more aerobic capacity you have, the more bone density you have, the higher your quality of life in every way. You're more likely to be good company because you feel well. So if you're down here at the bottom, you're bitching and moaning all the time about how your body's falling apart and nobody wants to be around you. Right? You want healthy old people to be around because they're fun. They're fun. And that lets you be sociable. And being sociable, it improves your health. So keep it up as high as you can and rehabilitate it as quickly as you can within reason so that you can die quickly. Now, speaking of dying quickly, I want to make a point about death. The question is, how long can we live? The text addresses it. I just want to clarify a couple of things. If you start at birth with a whole cohort of people, 100% of them are alive, and once they're born into that cohort, that group of people born in the year 1900, whatever it is, no more are going to be born that year when the year is over. So you have 100%. But what they are going to do is die. If you graph how many of them are still alive, that's your mortality or survival graph, you're going to reach a point when 50% of them are dead. That's your average lifespan. Okay, so now we see that as we've improved our care of infants, we've improved our health care over the last several centuries, the average lifespan has increased. So now it's up to what, 75 or something like that for men who are born this year? It's going to be 80 and so forth. Over time, as a society improves its nutrition and health care, the average lifespan increases. You're just moving that curve over. The interesting thing is that the maximum lifespan has not changed. You can always find somebody in every cohort who makes it to 115 to 123. That's the maximum lifespan. The text says 120, but you know, Marie Calmont in France was 124, I think, when she died about 5 years ago. Currently, the oldest people in the world are about 115. Okay. Eventually, we should all be able to live that long. But the question is, can we live longer than that? Can we make it 150 or 200 years? And the best guesses are no. We're not going to be able to do that. Because the body seems, for some reason, to be designed to give out. It just wears itself out. And the text describes several different theories about why we age and die. And I recommend that you study those theories about why we die so that you'll be prepared for Monday.